The name of the new book is The Diversity Principle, The Story of a Transformative Idea. David Oppenheimer is our guest, a clinical professor of law at University of California, Berkeley, and a great pleasure to welcome David Oppenheimer to the roundtable this morning. Thank you very much for being with us. A great pleasure to have you on the program.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to join you.
What brought you to want to look at the history of diversity, especially as we are in the moment that we're in now of where you look at this and say a history is needed?
So, ironically, when I started this project, we were at a very different time when companies were adopting diversity policies, when universities all had diversity policies, when I was skeptical about whether diversity was really a meaningful idea, or alternatively, whether it was really sort of pop psychology and the idea of the moment and maybe an excuse for having a few minority students in the room, but at colleges, and a few minority employees, but not really a deep commitment. And I suggested that to a colleague who pushed back very hard and said, if you're going to go around saying that, you've got to really examine the question. She was absolutely right. It began what was a 12-year research project with a large number of research assistants from Berkeley and other universities. And my conclusion is that diversity has a very deep and profound role in higher education and in business and in science and government that goes back over 200 years, that it was a foundation of the modern research university. It's the reason that the University of Berlin, which was the model, the first modern research university, admitted Catholics and Jews to what otherwise would have been a Protestant university. It was a primary principle in the work on liberty by John Stuart Mill and Harriet Taylor Mill. It played a very important role in the development of First Amendment law in the United States and in the development of academic freedom. It was essential in the desegregation cases of the 20th century, and it has become a principle which is well established empirically. So it's gone from what seemed like a good idea 200 years ago to what we now know through thousands of scientific studies is an important component of good decision making.
The subtitle of the book is The Story of a Transformative Idea. Over this long history, what has led to those various transformations?
Well, in large part, the experience of people who were outsiders who, because of their extraordinary talent, were allowed to at least participate with insiders. And so you have Wilhelm von Humboldt and his remarkable wife, Caroline, who Goethe called the most important woman of her age, whose many experiments with diversity coming out of being born, well, he particularly being born as an outsider in Berlin, as a Huguenot refugee, learned so much and contributed so much from his experiences as an outsider that he was able to see the benefits of diversity in ways that others couldn't. You know that old aphorism that great minds think alike? I grew up with that aphorism, and it's only now that I realize that it's completely wrong. that the diversity principle completely upends it and says, no, great minds think differently. That's the source of their greatness. And you see this again and again. You see it with the Mills, Harriet Taylor Mill, who was deprived of an education, John Stuart Mill, who couldn't attend Oxford or Cambridge because he was a Unitarian. And their brilliant ideas linking liberty with the importance of diversity, viewpoint diversity, experiential diversity, nationality diversity, and class diversity, and the way they connect that to the essential functions of a democracy and to the essential functions of higher education. You see it again in the way that Charles Eliot transformed Harvard from being a sort of a sleepy college to being a great university through his commitment to the clash of ideas and his commitment to admitting Catholics and Jews and poor students and black students and the children of immigrants and immigrants themselves to Harvard because he saw the value in diversity. And at the turn of the 20th century, people writing about higher education were contrasting Harvard and Princeton and saying Princeton celebrates the fact that it is only a place for white Protestant men. And its homogeneity they see as a strength. Well, Harvard celebrates its diversity, and Harvard sees that as its strength. Now, I don't want to say who won out over the next 125 years. Princeton is a very fine school, but Harvard has become the model of the greatest university in the world, in part because of that commitment to diversity.
You write about foundations of academic freedom, and of course, diversity very much a part of that, as you have already outlined a bit. Give us a sense of how of the links between the between higher education and academic freedom, and why diversity is so important within those tenets.
Well, diversity is essential to academic freedom for the ideas expressed so eloquently by Humboldt and by the Mills about the importance of hearing minority voices, hearing the voices of those who are outsiders in order to confront our own beliefs and our own biases and prejudices. But what happened in terms of the law of academic freedom in the United States, I found so interesting because the language of the law of academic freedom came out of the challenge against apartheid in South Africa. The leaders of the two universities in South Africa that were racially integrated and that were resisting apartheid wrote a small book called The Open Universities in South Africa. And one of them was both the chancellor at the University of Cape Town and the chief justice of South Africa. And so he had become friendly with Felix Frankfurter, a justice on the U.S. Supreme Court. And they were trading notes back and forth as the South Africans were writing this small book that said that racial diversity is so important in a multiracial society that as a matter of academic freedom, you have to allow us to continue to admit black students. And when he finished this, he sent it off to Frankfurter, and Frankfurter inserted the language and the description about the meaning of academic freedom into a McCarthy-era case on academic freedom, and that grew into the language that we use today when we describe the law of academic freedom in the United States. It's a great story.
David Oppenheimer is our guest. The name of the new book, The Diversity Principle, The Story of a Transformative Idea. The book is published by Yale. Part three of the book is called The Diversity Principle is Embraced but Then Rejected by Conservative Supreme Court Justices. Let me put the word conservative aside for a moment and just look at the diversity principle in relationship to our courts.
Sure. I mean, the initial argument that racial diversity was so important to the mission of a university that it should be a basis, a proper basis, for allowing a university to consider race and ethnicity in making admissions decisions came out of an argument made by Archibald Cox, who was one of the great lawyers of the 20th century and was embraced by Justice Lewis Powell, who we now think of as a moderate, but in many ways, Justice Powell was a great conservative figure and a great conservative hero. He wrote the memo that gave rise to the birth of the Federalist Society. He was the general counsel or advisor to the Chamber of Commerce and persuaded the Chamber of Commerce that it had to become a voice at the Supreme Court in favor of conservative and pro-business views. And Powell wrote the opinion in the Bakke case using language from Archibald Cox's amicus curiae brief from 4 years earlier in another case that became the model for diversity-based affirmative action for 45 years. And it was re-endorsed by the Supreme Court in 2003 by Justice O'Connor. It was re-endorsed again by Justice Kennedy. And for 45 years, members of the court across the political spectrum agreed that one of the things that was important to the mission of many universities and colleges was to have a diverse student body because of the educational benefits of diversity. That, of course, changed in 2023 with a very different court and a decision that any consideration of race, at least on the basis of the need for diversity, did not justify using race in college admissions.
You talk in the book about going from diversity to DEI, to adding those words equity and inclusion. How did that change things?
Well, I think there was a recognition by the people who are sometimes described as the diversity scientists, those who began studying diversity in the late 20th century and asking the question, does diversity really matter? And what they found was that there was a danger that diversity could lead simply to tokenism, and that in order to get past the problem of tokenism, you had to not only encourage a company or a university or a government entity to think about diversity in terms of who they hired, but you also had to think about how to include people of color, how to include women, how to include people with disabilities in the work of the organization so that they didn't feel that they were sidelined, that they were put into sort of positions that were not as important, that they were really treated as part of the organization. And that's where the idea of inclusion came. And then the idea of equity, simply of fairness, that diversity is about the benefits of having a group of people who have different backgrounds and experiences. But when we talk about DEI, we're talking about a civil rights concept that includes not just what's good for a company or what's good for a university, but what's fair to the members of society, what's fair to those who are otherwise treated as outsiders. So I think that while my book is primarily about this idea of diversity, I wanted to include material about this idea of DEI, of diversity, equity, and inclusion, because it speaks to one of the reasons why diversity matters, beyond the simple fact that diversity gives us better decision making, gives us more significant discoveries in business, leads to greater business success. But it's also, in addition, about fairness to women and minorities and people with disabilities, others who would be made outsiders in the absence of DEI policies.
The name of the book is The Diversity Principle. David Oppenheimer is the author and our guest this morning. So where are we now as the Trump administration continues to wage war against diversity? And I guess when you look at the history, it brings up a follow-up question, which is, will we always be at war against diversity?
Well, I hope not. The Trump administration is convinced that the very idea of diversity is itself wrong, is itself unfair. The president has said that the 1964 Civil Rights Act and that which came afterward was terribly unfair to white men. I find that sort of absurd when we look at the success of white men in our society. You could only believe that the civil rights laws are unfair to white men if you think that white men should be the only people in charge and that there's no room for anyone else. But yeah, the Trump administration has taken the position that any kind of diversity program is illegal. That's just not true. They may succeed in convincing the Supreme Court ultimately that that is true, but I doubt it. The opinions of the Supreme Court, even of the most recent opinions, have suggested that the court does not view diversity as a bad thing or as a term that is equal to discrimination against white people or anyone else. And it's a lot of rhetoric that's very damaging, but when they actually have to go to court and defend themselves, the courts, regardless of the political or ideological background of the judges, are almost entirely rejecting their claims.
The idea of woke being used as shorthand for this, it seems like we're even losing definition, if we ever firmly had one, of what that means in relationship to diversity.
There's this tendency to take any kind of slang and to mystify it and change the meaning of it. And when I first heard the term woke, my understanding was it was a way of suggesting that somebody was awake, that they were alert, that they were somebody who had a good understanding of the world around them. And I think it comes out of jazz. I think it comes out of musicians who had what we might call great situational awareness. And so they would say, "Nah, that drummer is woke." And it was a compliment about that drummer's ability to hear what was being played and to interact with it effectively and beautifully and to help make beautiful music. Now, of course, it's a term that's used to disparage people who believe in the importance of the civil rights and equality rights, people who believe such things as Black Lives Matter. It's very odd that a term that in its origins is so, one, complementary, and two, non-controversial, has been turned into this this insult.
So let me ask maybe the hardest question. I'll end with this one, David.
Good.
Which is
the harder the better. that's one of the benefits of diversity.
Yes, indeed. But
disagreement is how we learn.
There's a reason, though, that it resonates, right? I mean, if woke and the words that are being used and the war, there is. We'll see if the pendulum swings, but the fact that it is resonating, and you made the very good point about white men, but I'm just wondering of what it says about us that the fact that this comes up, and there seems to be at one time a latent anger that has been awoken, that we suddenly look at it and say, okay, this is going to be our issue. And I'm curious as to, there has to be the reason why that is resonating with people, and arguably one of the reasons that the president won the election in 2024.
Agreed. And if you look at the data, white men make a lot more money than any other group. If you look, for example, at census data, the most recent census data on college graduates between the ages of 24 and 35, that is people who are just starting their careers after graduating from college, the median income for a full-time employed white man is in the range of $75,000, and for Hispanic, Latina, or black woman is just over $50,000. Men make more money than women. White people make more money than black or Hispanic people. And there are a lot of white men who would like to keep that going, who don't like the idea that there should be equality, don't like the idea that women should make as much as men, don't like the idea that black people should earn as much as white people. If you look at the wealth in this country, it is overwhelmingly held by white people. And the idea that over time that should change is offensive to a lot of white folks out there. And we should not be surprised by that, but neither should we be endorsing that or thinking of that as an argument about fairness. It's not an argument about fairness. The notion that white men are being treated unfairly is so clearly refuted by any data. It's just stories that are either made up or taken out of context or occasional as opposed to being the norm.
David Oppenheimer is a clinical professor of law at the University of California, Berkeley. The new book is The Diversity Principle, the story of a transformative idea. It is published by Yale University Press. Professor Oppenheimer, I thank you very much for spending time with us. It's been a great joy to have you on the program, and I thank you very much for your knowledge and time.
Thanks so much for inviting me, and happy to come back anytime.
Again, the name of the book is The Diversity Principle, The Story of a Transformative Idea. David Oppenheimer is the guest. The book is published by Yale. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.